Tribeca Film Festival for a film I made with Harmony Korine called The Fourth Dimension. And it was very well received for an experimental film.
Well, good.
And, yeah, I got to hang out a little bit with my old friend Robert De Niro and Peter Brandt and his wife Stephanie Seymour, all fancy, fancy, pretty people.
Oh, very cool. Now, you live in L.A., right?
I do now, yes. It's hard for me to say that still, but yes, I'm committing because I've lived in New Mexico for 25 years, and I sold my main house and kept some property, and I'm going to build again. But I have to get back into my business, so I'm saying I live in L.A. and I'm going to try to not explain why from now on.
Now, are you still going to remain active with the film industry in New Mexico? I know you were a big proponent for getting people to shoot more movies there. Are you still going to work for that, or?
Yes, yes. I'm trying to whenever I can. When we started, it was with Governor Johnson, and I encouraged him to a very simple plan. Any state can do it. You just gather up the best business plans and business incentives for filming in your state and try to improve them. By, you know, you can hire a Hollywood lawyer, and that's what we did in New Mexico, and then offered a plan to the industry. And you know, if you ever wonder why there's so much work in, you know, South Carolina or Louisiana or Canada or now New Mexico, that's why. It's very easy. Just put together a tax incentive that makes it cheaper to film there, and you get business immediately. I'm really proud of that because we started, Jessica, with three million dollars our first year worth of business, not profit, but that's the contracts that we had, and now we're up over $4 billion and just three governors, so it's pretty amazing. Fastest growing business in New Mexico since the atom bomb.
Have you ever been to Hannibal?
I haven't, but I'm sure excited to go. I just love to travel. I've been doing it my whole life, and I'm not unlike Twain. I've just got a wandering spirit, and he was extraordinary how much ground he covered, considering how slow transportation was back then. You know, all the way to Australia, and lived abroad, all told about 10 years. It's amazing, and to be so well known in so many places means he didn't just arrive in Sydney, Australia, and hang out in his hotel room. He really moved around every place he ever went.
That said, it's a pretty tall order to portray him. What inspired you to take on this role that is, frankly, very different from any role I believe you've ever tackled?
Yeah. Well, he's you know, don't need to describe his greatness. That there's nothing I can say in any original way. Oh, so it's hard to imagine someone not loving Mark Twain. I was looking years and years ago for a film to do that would captivate my interest for many years, because it often takes 4 or 5 years to put a movie together, or even 10 or 15 years. I'm sorry to say I'm beginning to be in the category of the latter. I've been working on this movie for about 7 or 8 years now. But it's about Mark Twain and Mary Baker Eddy, who he was obsessed with the last 10 years of his life. And it's a period of time in our nation's history where we had such a high regard for the individual and the spirit of just becoming, just awakening to our greatness was so vital to us the excitement of our laws and the individualism that each state, you know, everyone was just young and flexing their muscles. So the idea of a story that captures, I would say, a proper spirit of American individualism was what I was settling in on, trying to find a story that would suit that. And that's how I came up with these, doing a dual biography about Mrs. Eddy, who shares many, many similarities to Mark Twain, and yet is completely different than him. So in one way, it's a way to talk about just the feminine individualism and greatness in America, because I don't deal with her religion, although she embodied her beliefs, so you get a kind of feeling about what the Christian Scientist principles are, but it's not about that at all. I don't think it's even mentioned in the movie, but she's just trying to get through her day, and Twain's trying to get through his day, and he wants to meet her, but she won't meet him. And it's all based on true events in these last several years of their lives. So that's what attracted me, that the opposites are fairly obvious if you know anything about Mrs. Eddy. And Twain was hilarious about all religions. And he even wrote a book about Mrs. Eddy called Christian Science, but it's his worst book. So I thought, you know, it's so dynamic, like America, his story about having achieved everything, but he can't get this one thing, so he can't let it go. He won't just let Mrs. Eddy alone. He writes these terrible things in the newspapers all the time and actually expressed some pretty opposite nature to how we regard him. I mean, I would assume anyone who's read anything of Twain in a biography knows that he was really concerned with the truth, and was a tireless, socially conscious individual. He spoke out against the atrocities of how we were treating the Chinese immigrants in San Francisco when he was just a kid, and against the oppression of the Hawaiian people when he visited the Sandwich Islands. And his whole life, it's obviously what his contribution to the black community and against slavery is hard to match any private individual, what he contributed in his time, of course. So that's how I got into it.
You're right. Few escaped his criticism. He was very socially active, very outspoken, and kind of known for being unapologetic and having salty language. Is that what we can expect to see in your soliloquy as you take him to the stage?
Well, what I'm very happy to report from Los Angeles is that there's no mistaking that he's a comedian first. I intended several years ago when I started in on the play to just do a stand-up style of short, meaning about an hour, what the stand-ups do, and just keeping it light. But it really didn't, it was never totally satisfying. It's really wonderful to tell a joke and get a laugh back, or a big laugh or applause, because it's so gratifying and it's so pure. There's, you know, you can tell when you do something dramatic on stage because it's so quiet that people are, it's a wonderful thing, the theater, because, you know, it's really clear you're just part of the creation. You're telling a story with the audience. They're saying, they're really your director and telling you what they want and how they want it. And I love it. I've always loved the theater more than filmmaking. I just got caught up in projects that required lots of money, so I made a lot more movies than theater. But Twain also, he just has an enormous appetite and this great, great desire to entertain the audience. So it's mainly a comedy, but I couldn't help, it really felt dishonest in a way not to reveal aspects of his life. It's a workshop, so I hope the audience is understanding with new material that, you know, it's a true workshop. I really am writing it every day and trying something new every night to try and make the play better. Usually that's done in one place, but I've also just had this sensibility about doing the play in as many different locations as I can. I talked to some promoters up in San Francisco and very different audience than Los Angeles. And I did it in North Dakota. Of course, I want to do it in the Southwest and in my state of New Mexico, but I'm planning on doing it in Texas in May and up and down the coast. I'm also filming a documentary where I'll be going up and down the Mississippi to try and find Mark Twain.
Any of his literary works that you've looked at that you really are trying to sort of bring to life?
Well, the film that I've written is specifically about his obsession with Mrs. Eddy, and through that you really understand that a man that I find is almost a perfect case study about America. You know, it's attributed to him that he said, "I'm not an American, I'm the American." And when you first hear that, it sounds so grand and pretentious. But then when you get involved in his life, in the real life, where he made, you know, so many crazy moves as a businessman, just so antithetical to his understanding spirit as a writer, that you see this kind of split personality going on that's very similar to the United States. I mean, I think, I would hope that no matter where I came from, I could recognize that there's no government in the history of civilization that is as sensitive as the principles that are enacted every day that make up the United States. It's why we captured the world's consciousness almost immediately, and why we lead the planet in a way of thinking. You know, we dominate the point of view of what we're doing as a species on Earth. And Mark Twain was so aware of the mindset of the great people of his time, obviously the great writers, but the kings and queens and the hoi polloi, the wealthy, but not more so than the everyday working man. He really understood everything about our country, what it means to be an American, and he didn't ever look outside of that for inspiration. It was plenty to just walk down the street. And so that real love that is who he is about all mankind led, I think, to these, you know, great realizations and summations in simple but brilliant sentences. And, you know, he's a master satirist. I don't think we've got a greater one still today. And so, of course, if he put his laser X-ray vision on politics, he said stuff 100 years ago that's just as hilarious and true today, you know, is worth considering. In my play, I'll tell a secret, so I hope it doesn't ruin it for you if you get to see it. But he starts off admitting that he knows he's dead. And he did that a lot. And I don't know why it's so funny, except to see that his interest in himself, or himself in context,
to what might be the America of 100 years from now, meaning today, was so strong that he wrote about it. He said, well, now I'm dead, I'll tell you what I think about it. It's 100 years later. And so I just put that into the play. But he's also wrestling with his, or what I'm imagining is his current dilemmas that, you know, he, according to lots and lots of beliefs, you keep going and there's no death. So now he's trying to work out, you know, being a better person, in quotes, out there in the limbo. I don't call it purgatory, but he made lots and lots of jokes about heaven and hell. So some of those are incorporated into it. But I hope we get a sense, at least this is my getting the a consistent reaction that's positive, getting a sense of loving life and some of the simple practices of how to enjoy life more. Like Twain, you know, suffered enormous tragedy throughout his life, right up to his last year. He lost his daughter on Christmas Eve in their house. And he'd been estranged from his only daughter that was left to him for quite a while. She ended up coming back in the, his last couple of years. But he was, you know, a true American. And I hope that you get a sense of what it, how great it is to be an American. And my particular, what I've settled in on for how I'm, what I love most about that, with that meaning what I love most about the opportunity that being an American offers us, is to be an individual but to not judge. We've, you know, we created a government where you could come and be any religion, be any color, and be embraced as a fully counted individual. And I think that he was trying to do that his whole life and was very successful at it.
And, you know, you've put a lot of thought and effort into embodying Twain as a person, as a, as you said, an American, and sort of how he is this this huge icon of literature and commentary, et cetera. Bringing that to stage, you also have to perfect the look. And I've got to tell you, whenever I got the picture with the press release, I was kind of blown away. And you've been cast in various roles where you're made to look very good. Was it a surprise to you to look in the mirror and kind of look like a crazy bedraggled old man?
Well, it wasn't a surprise. I was happy because, you know, I have had some pretty amazing artistic eyes looking at some of these photos, you know, friends like Francis Coppola or Ron Howard, and they've had to ask, you know, is that you, or is that, you know, it's my face just happens to lend itself to some of Twain's, you know, older features, although that nose is amazing. I mean, it, you don't really notice it because of his giant hair and his giant mustache, but he's got a schnoz on him. It's amazing. But anyway, it is. I've never played anybody this old, so it is quite an interesting, because it's. I guess you'd say it's mixed up with his genius. The age part about being, it's more about thinking than sort of how, what it feels like moving around. He was kind of a rattled trap, always looking for just, I wouldn't say scatterbrained, but he was, because he wrote every day with enormous discipline and the high, high volume of excellence, no matter what he turned his attentions on. Very consistent writer. But to have the day not track, at one point he said, talking about age. I wonder if there's ever a day where you actually feel your age all day long. And he went on to at length about talking about how, you know, that when you're old, you don't really feel old. Just old things keep happening to you, but you feel this. He certainly lived out a youthful spirit his whole life. So it's interesting. It's very challenging, though. It's gratifying, of course, to play a genius because I feel my life so improved by studying both Mrs. Eddy and Mark Twain. She's not, I should make a point if I was not clear before, she's not the subject of this evening with Twain. He mentions her a couple times because, I want to kind of root some of his character flaws in his obsession with her, but it's not anything more than a couple of paragraphs over the whole course of the evening. So, it's been really gratifying to pretend to be this smart for an hour and a half every night.
So do you hope that audiences will come away with an appreciation or a bigger appreciation for Twain or for you as an actor or both?
Well, I mean, I always hope you can do a good job as an actor, but I can't say that I've had the specific ambition to be seen as being good. When you create a role, you just try to be as effective as you can, and really, really gratified that the audiences are enjoying what I've presented, particularly as a writer. I would say more as a writer than as an actor, because I really love the theater, so it's not a foreign world to me, even though I probably have to say I'm probably not thought of as a theater actor anymore. There was quite a long period when I was younger where I'd done more plays than movies. I remember keeping track of that for a while. But into the 90s, when I started doing really large movies, that it really fell away, where it was basically I would estimate I only averaged a play every 4 or 5 years, which is not enough to say you're a theater actor. I can say honestly that it's my only true love in the arts that I can do anyway. I love all the arts, but I can act on stage. So it's what I think about as I'm on my way to rehearsal even today. It's just those, just trying to be as honest and challenging to my own, you know, what makes a character dynamic or any kind of art is where the artist is as truthful about their flaws as they are about whatever they imagine that they do well. That's what gives art life. And I'm still so dazzled by it. I mean, when you think about it, it's such a strange thing and wonderful. But a painting is alive, and it stays alive in your memory. The choices, what the artist puts on the canvas or what he leaves off of the canvas, you know, the space, a relationship to color and shape, that what's in their soul or in their mind or what's bouncing back and forth between those two zones gets captured somehow in paint or materials and sculpture or whatever, and then it stays alive and goes on and on and on. It's really an amazing accomplishment. Any artist does something that continues to delight an audience, then I picked art to describe that because it's so singular. You know, it's just that two-dimensional canvas. So it's really a containable, simple thing, like talking about a song that the Beatles wrote as children, basically, in 1963. That still is important sentiment, and not just because you know the song, it's because there's real soul in it. It's an amazing thing, art. So I'm really happy now at this point where I'm well into my second act as an actor, that I'm still this excited to go to work. I really happy that I found Mark Twain to center my attentions on. I should mention too, I hope, I don't know how short your article is, but I hope you could shove something aside if it is, does have to be short, because we've talked a lot. But I want to mention how debt I owe to Hal Holbrook, too, who's been doing Mark Twain on stage tirelessly since 1954. I have specifically kept away from some pieces that some people have mentioned would be perhaps associated with some of his great collections. His play he's got many different plays that make up an evening with Mark Twain called Mark Twain Tonight. So you can't just say that there's a play that he does. He takes from every part of Twain's canon. But I talked to him about it, and I said, you know, I was intending to make this film and do a one-man show in preparation for it. And I hope that was okay with him. And he said, sure, just don't do my stuff. So I wanted to say how much he's meant to me and how great he's been on stage. And I'm not in any way feeling any kind of competition about him or from him. So I'm happy. I hope that doesn't ever get misconstrued by any shoddy journalist.
No shoddy journalists here. I think he was most recently in Tennessee, or did do some touring in Tennessee. Is that?
Yes.
Is that what you understand? But you had mentioned earlier that you were going to be hitting some stops up and down the Mississippi. Will you be?
Yeah.
Will you be going to Memphis?
Yes. Eventually, that and thinking more about the documentary I'm making. And I also reached out to him since we met I want to interview him for my documentary on Mark Twain, which he's agreed to do. So that's exciting.
And you mentioned a song. I believe we are going to be treated to some songs on stage. Is that right?
Yes, four or five.
Four or five. And I don't think that I knew until recently that you did all of your own vocals in the Doors.
I did. That was a lot of fun, because that was very, I was going to say like theater, but it was theater. We even though it's a couple thousand extras, they were surprisingly involved, even though we were only doing, one song for 15 hours. It was quite satisfying to get that audience reaction every time. That was, I think it's still something, that film still stands up as being the best rock and roll movie by most people's account. And I'm real proud of being able to do something like that where, I mean, even the director was saying, well, why do you want to sing the songs? No. Yeah, he's a baritone tenor. Nobody sounds like him. I said, I know, but I don't know if I can do it. But if I can, wouldn't that be better? And he couldn't say no. So off we went, and that was a great adventure. And with this, it's really fun. I mean, the old Negro spirituals are so evocative, and they're so overtly emotional. It's really fun to do them. And, Twain is very, very clever by his use of cliches and a kind of deceptive
active. He fools you quite often with a kind of attitude in his characters, and sets up things that you could call archetypes, or maybe they are absolutely archetypes. And then once you trust, oh, I know who that guy is. That's the drunk, that's the town drunk, or that's the slave, and he believes in magic, so he's kind of dumb or something. And then he puts into that mouth of that river rat Huck Finn the most profound, important thoughts about humankind, those kind of thoughts that really matter. I mean, when you think of it, he was so effective as an artist, so entertaining, that a racist, either from the north to south, had to adjust and give his story space, new space in their mind, where if you're on that journey with Huck Finn or Tom or any of the characters in these classics, you have to treat those people differently than you do in the daytime or, you know, out there in the world. And he shifted consciousness just by being that funny and that clever. No politician in that time after the Civil War comes to mind like Mark Twain about a contribution to getting our head screwed on straight about what it means to be an American. I don't think. I think he made a major contribution after the Civil War. He really brought home the reality that the Civil War was a failure. It did not end racism. It did not establish equality with everybody. And I mean, I say this in the play, paraphrasing some of his thoughts, but every woman knows that slavery is not over. Every conscious person knows that racism is festering a mile away from the theater. It's a reality, but not a reality that's going to last forever. And he's one of the real pioneers about equality.